When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Everybody dies, don't they?
Some come back, don't they?
Isn't that so?
You tried to get into the locked drawer today, didn't you?
How do the dead come back, Mother? What's the secret?
The Topley Place Sale by A.N.L. Mundy. I wish you'd tell me all about the Topley Place Sale, I said. What do you mean, all about it? Asked my companion. Well, I replied, I heard that something rather odd occurred in connection with it, which wasn't given any publicity at the time. Ian Maxwell, a member of a well-known firm of art auctioneers, looked at me quizzically across the luncheon table. I think I'm being pumped, he said. I've no idea how much you do know, but if there are stories going round about it, you'd better hear the truth. But 6 months ago, a man named Dunton came to see me. I knew him by name. He was a stockbroker, and I'd once had some dealings with his firm. He told me that he'd just inherited Topley Place, being apparently the nephew of old Sir Robert Topley, who just died. I knew that Dunton was a rich man, and my first thought was how fortunate it was that the place had got an owner who could afford to spend some money on it. It's a glorious house, but it wants a little doing to it. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It was described in Country Life about 10 years ago, an entirely unspoilt Jacobean house. I congratulated Dunton on his good fortune, but he seemed very lukewarm about it. He said it was a white elephant, inaccessible and inconvenient, that he would never consider living there, and would let it, if he could find a tenant. Then he went on to say, I believe there's some very good furniture down there, and pictures too. I want you to send a man down with me when I go there tomorrow for the first time. I never knew the old man very well. In fact, I only inherit by virtue of being the nearest relation. I said that I would be glad to accompany him myself and asked him if he knew of any pictures of particular interest. His reply will give you a pretty good idea of the sort of man he was. I haven't the faintest idea, he said, but I can tell you this. If there's anything saleable, it's coming straight up to Tyne. You won't find me keeping thousands of pounds worth of capital locked up on the walls. I've no sympathy with that sort of sentiment. A fellow came to see me the other day about raising some money, said he was hard up, and I know for a fact that he has a couple of Gainsboroughs in his dining room. If you'll come down to Topley with me tomorrow and pick out anything good, I want it sold this season. It's no use waiting. Prices, I understand, are pretty good, and that money might be earning 5%. Well, as you know, selling works of art is my bread and butter, so I ought to have been pleased, but there was something almost disgusting in the man's eagerness to scatter his dead uncle's possessions to the four wind. It wasn't as if he needed the money. However, I naturally agreed, and we arranged to meet at Paddington at 10 o'clock on the following day. We had an uneventful journey down to Somerset, and arrived at the house about lunchtime. It was a really charming place and had obviously been well cared for, but one could see that there hadn't been quite enough money to make it into a show place. As it was Dunton's first visit, the agent had got all the servants lined up to greet their new master. It was all rather old-fashioned, but personally I liked that sort of thing. It was then that I first realised what a complete outsider Dunton was. The occasion obviously demanded a little speech, but he made not the slightest attempt to be civil, and even had the consummate bad taste to start a discussion on the question of staff reduction in their presence. The agent sent them off and started to show us round the house. He was a very decent fellow called Elliot, a man of about 50, who'd been there for nearly 30 years. Of course, as soon as he had realised that Dunton had brought me down to strip the place of its pictures and furniture, he regarded me with considerable hostility, and I can't altogether blame him. Dunton treated him like dirt, and I was there as Dunton's professional adviser. I don't think I've ever had quite such an embarrassing day, and I'm pretty hardened to going round houses. Well, there were some very nice things, and I made a list as we went. A big panel of Gobelin tapestry, some very fair armour, a good refectory table, two really fine William and Mary inlaid cabinets, and a lot of other very saleable furniture. The pictures, too, were promising. Nothing sensational, mostly good English school. A Richard Wilson, two Zoffanys, as well as a delightful Guardi. In the study, there were some modern pictures, none of much account, except for one magnificent early John portrait, which I realised was of Dunton, painted probably 30 years before. He told me that his uncle had commissioned it in 1910. I was interested to compare my companion's face with the picture, to see how much his material success had filled out the features, giving him an air of complacency that was lacking in the painting. But even in his early 20s, his mouth had assumed its present hard line. Of course, it didn't occur to me that he would want to sell his own portrait, but he asked me what I thought it would fetch. I gave a rough estimate of £300 or £400, and he recalled with considerable glee that his uncle had only paid the artist 100 guineas in 1910. "The best investment he ever made," he said. "Send it up with the rest of the stuff." So I added it to my list and we passed on. I was desperately sorry for the agent. He had grown up with the place and was obviously very proud of it, and I could imagine that on hearing of the wealth of the new owner, he had been planning all sorts of improvements. But instead of improvements, Dunton seemed intent on denuding the house of all its treasures. However, Elliot didn't say much, but accompanied us from room to room. In the small drawing room, we stopped in front of a picture of a naval officer on the wall. Below, on a table, were laid out what had obviously been his belongings. A great silver-mounted telescope, a gilt dress sword with a presentation inscription upon it, and a pair of finely engraved pistols. In a case nearby was a suit of naval uniform. Elliot pointed to them and said emphatically, "Well, anyhow, you can't sell these. They're heirlooms and entailed." Dunton rounded on him angrily. "Don't try to teach me my business," he snapped. "Do you think I don't know the conditions of my inheritance? I'm not a tenant for life as my uncle was. I am the absolute owner of this property, and as such, I can sell what I choose. And if I ever require your advice on the subject, I'll ask for it." I hastened to interpose. "I don't really think that they'd fetch very much in the open market," I said. "They are the sort of things that are of the greatest family interest, but they're not really early enough to attract the collector. I doubt if they'd sell for more than a few pounds." Dunton ignored my remarks, and looking coldly at the agent, he said, "Put them down on the list." Of course, the man was a sadist. He was just out to show Elliot who was master. If the agent hadn't suggested that they couldn't be sold, Dunton would have taken my advice. As it was, I had no choice but to note them down. They were perfectly readily saleable, but it seemed so unnecessary to take them from where they belonged for the sake of the few pounds that they'd bring in the auction room. The agent turned quite pale with anger. I thought he was going to tell Dunton exactly what he thought of him. However, he controlled himself and merely said, "You may be right about the legal side of the question. I dare say there's no actual ban on your selling, but if you'll take my advice, you won't do it." Admiral Topley was a quick-tempered man, and I shouldn't like to ignore his instructions, even if he has been dead 100 years. It was his expressed wish that these relics should be preserved in his house, and I should have thought that you might have respected his request. However, you won't be influenced by my views on the subject. But don't say that I didn't warn you." On saying this, he turned abruptly and left us. Dunton seemed more amused than annoyed. The incident typified for him the sentiment that he found so ridiculously unworldly. I looked with interest at the portrait. Though obviously not the work of a first-class artist, one could not fail to be struck by the figure depicted. It was full length and showed an officer in the naval uniform of the time of Nelson, and like Nelson, lacked an arm. The empty left sleeve was neatly pinned across the breast. The face was of a proud, imperious man, used to giving orders and to being obeyed with alacrity. The nose was aquiline, and the cheekbones rather high. I have seldom seen a more obviously patrician face. The artist had caught well the weather-beaten, mahogany complexion born of long exposure. I agreed with Elliot that he had probably been quick-tempered. He looked as though he would be intolerant of any interference with his wishes and would bitterly resent any affront. We passed on, and I found a few more things to send up to the sale. When I went back to town that night, I had every reason to be pleased with myself, but I couldn't get the memory of Dunton's boorishness and Elliot's distress out of my mind. However, it obviously wasn't politic to quarrel with my client, and if we didn't undertake the sale, I was quite sure that he would merely find another auctioneer. And the Topley Place sale was obviously going to be one of the highlights of a fairly commonplace season. In due course, the stuff was sent up to our rooms, and we set to work on preparing the catalogue. Our picture man was very pleased with his share of the sale, and made a big thing of the Guardi. I decided to catalogue the portrait and relics of Admiral Topley myself. I had an irrational desire to do the old man proud and to write him up well in the catalogue. I searched about for information on him and his career. I didn't find much, though. He had never been a great figure in the Navy, becoming a Rear Admiral only a year before his retirement in 1807. In 1790, I discovered he had fought a duel and his opponent had died of his wounds. But the affair didn't seem to have affected his career, because he was a captain commanding a ship of the line at Camperdown under Duncan, where he lost his arm. The silver gilt sword was given to him by the city of Wells, where he lived at that time. He inherited Topley Place in 1804, but didn't settle there until 6 years later. He lived there until his death in 1831 at the age of 83. I got my leg pulled a good deal for spending so much more time on the old man than could be justified by the price he would fetch, but I didn't care. The catalogue was printed and sent out. I expect you got a copy. A week before the sale, the property was put on view in the large gallery. I had the Admiral hung in an alcove with a table in front of him, on which were spread out his pistols, sword, telescope and uniform. I felt quite ashamed when I saw him there with a lot number in the corner of his frame, looking, I thought, more imperious than ever. I'd done my best to interest a few possible purchasers in him, writing to the Maritime Museum at Greenwich and to Wells about his sword, but I couldn't see the whole lot fetching more than about £25. The portrait of Dunton by John, on the other hand, aroused a lot of interest, both in the trade and among private collectors, and I don't mind telling you that we had several substantial bids left with us for it. Up to now, I expect you found this story pretty straightforward, but just before the sale, something very odd indeed occurred. If I hadn't been so intimately concerned in it, and if I couldn't vouch for every detail myself, I should have considerable difficulty in believing it. As I expect you know, we employ a night watchman. We often have £50,000 worth of stuff in the galleries, and we can't afford to take any risks. Our watchman is a most reliable man who's been with us for years, an ex-sergeant from the Brigade of Guards. On the morning of the sale, I found him waiting for me in my office looking extremely worried. He told me that he'd been downstairs at about midnight when he thought he heard a report somewhere in the building. He had a good look around, but couldn't find anything, and eventually assumed, very naturally, that he had heard a car backfiring outside. But when daylight came, he discovered that the John portrait of Dunton had been defaced. Of course, when I heard this, I went quickly up to the gallery to have a look at it. I don't really expect that you'll believe me when I tell you what I found. There was a round hole in the head, and this was blackened round the edges as though it had been made with some firearm at point-blank range. The wall behind was not marked in any way, and, believe it or not, one of the Admiral's pistols had been fired. There was no mistake about that. They had been bright and clean, but now the barrel of one of them was fouled. My first thought was to ring up Dunton, The picture was insured, of course, but we should have to withdraw it from the sale. When I got through to his house, I received my second shock of the morning, for Dunton had died of heart failure during the night. Apparently, it wasn't altogether unexpected. His heart had been giving him trouble for years. Of course, this may have been purely fortuitous. Some madman may have broken into our premises, defaced the portrait. Dunton's death on the same night may have been mere coincidence. But I know, and you know, that that isn't the true explanation. It was one of those things which are at present outside the range of human experience. Naturally, the sale had to be postponed, as we had to get the new owner's instructions before proceeding. Dunton was unmarried, and his heir was a married sister of his. She and her husband were overjoyed at the possibility of living at Topley, and they wouldn't hear of the sale going on. Everything was returned to the house. I went down there again the other day. The Admiral was back in his rightful place, and though I felt that he'd lost us the best sale of the season, I was delighted to see him there. And I don't think that any future owner of Topley Place will be in a hurry to send him up to the sale room again.
Everybody dies, don't they? Isn't that so?
So that was The Alabaster Hand by A.N.L. Munby, published in 1949 by Dennis Dobson Limited. I'm going to tell you about the story and about A.N.L., of course, in due course, but I'll just explain how I came to be reading this story. Every now and again, somebody not more than every now and again, people contact me and say, do this story. Now, some of them I've already done. Other ones aren't suitable because they're too long or they're in copyright. But how this one happened was, I was on Facebook, I think, and it might have been the Classic Ghost Story Tradition or the M.R. James group on Facebook, and a guy called Nicholas Heward had bought a copy of The Alabaster Hand, which is the Topley Place sale is one of the short stories in The Alabaster Hand. And I said, oh, that looks good. Now, I didn't know much about A.N.L. Munby at the time, but obviously Nicholas does. And he said, oh, are you familiar with him? I said, no, not really, but I just like the look of it. Well, he got it secondhand for a reasonable price. And when you look at the cost of those books, they are expensive. They're real collector's issues. So he said, would you read one of the stories? I said, yeah, but I haven't got a copy of it. And tell you what he said. Tell you what? He didn't say it. We were typing it, and he probably didn't talk like that at all. He said, I'll post it all the way from America. So not the book, but he copied the pages of the Topley Place sale. And that is how I came to be doing it. So let me tell you something about the author, first of all. So Alan Noel Latimer, A-N-L, Alan Noel Latimer Munby, not Munby. There's a judge, a famous judge called Lord Justice Munby. I had a teacher called Lumby. Let's not get into rhymes of Lumby, Mumby, Numby. But so he was born on Christmas Day, 25th December 1913, just before the outbreak of the Great War, and died on 26th of December, Boxing Day, in 1974. Now, somebody's going to calculate. That makes him about 61, doesn't it? Which always makes me worried now because I've just turned 63 and everybody is going. Was a distinguished English librarian, bibliographer. Oh, come on, Tony. You should hear that. I was thinking actually when I was recording that I'm going to actually do a raw take. So you think I just read it all, but I don't. I'm stopping every, depending on the author and how easy they are to write, on also how much I've been narrating, because I think my mouth gets tired and I make more mistakes. But sometimes, and I'm cursing myself and I'm tripping over myself and my tongue won't do what I want it to do. So I thought I'd release one of those blooper ones, but then I thought there's some swearing in it, so it probably offends some of you. I mean, it's not massively bad swearing. It's just golly gosh and heck, drat, hell. Sorry, my mother and my grandmother, I would never say that in front of them. Hell, never. It's a swear word. Heck, but yeah, I could get away with heck. Anyway, back to A.N.L. Munby. So he was a distinguished English librarian, bibliographical scholar and book collector, noted for his contributions to the study of rare books and manuscripts. Additionally, he gained recognition as an author of ghost stories influenced by the style of M.R. James. Now, I'm not massively sure that was a very Jamesian story, but I haven't read the rest of the book because I haven't got hold of it, have I? Munby was born in Hampstead, love Hampstead, the son of architect Alan E. Munby and Ethel Greenhill. He received his education at Clifton College and later attended King's College, Cambridge, where he acquired the nickname Tim. Yeah, okay. That happens with nicknames, though. Munby's career encompassed various roles in the antiquarian book trade, including positions at Barnard Quaritch Limited and Sotheby & Company. During World War II, he served in the British Army and was later held as a prisoner of war. Following the war, he assumed the role of librarian at King's College, Cambridge. That was M.R. James's college, was it not? And was subsequently appointed as a fellow after probably James was gone by then, he was dead by that time. He held esteemed positions such as the J.P.R. Lyle Reader in Bibliography at the University of Oxford and the Sanders Reader in Bibliography at the University of Cambridge. Now, if you are familiar with those, either of those roles, you know more than me, and forgive me for any infelicities in my pronunciation. Munby was also a co-founder of the Cambridge Bibliographical Society and served as president of the Bibliographical Society until his passing in 1974. See, I said passing, not passing. Scholarly contributions, yeah. Munby's scholarly works include a comprehensive study of the eccentric 19th century book collector Sir Thomas Phillips, as well as a series of sale catalogues of libraries of eminent persons. He collaborated posthumously on a union list of British book sale catalogues, 1676 to 1800, with Leonora Coral. I think these are specialist interests, really. In addition to his scholarly pursuits, Munby authored a collection of ghost stories titled The Alabaster Hand. Alabaster. Yeah. Bastard. Mm. Three of these tales were written during his internment in Offlag 7B, Siebenbay, a German prisoner of war camp, and were featured in the prison camp magazine Touchstone. The stories, namely The Topley Place Sale, The Four Poster, and The White Sack, received acclaim for their subtle yet chilling narrative style, reminiscent of the tradition established by M.R. James. I see that, yeah. It's very genteel, you know. And there's no gore, there's no horror, nobody gets the head ripped off, nobody is disemboweled, the devil doesn't appear, there's nothing satanic about them. They're very mild, very, very mild. It's all very mild, very antiquarian. I get that. It's very big house, very nice big house, such as M.R. James doesn't write massively about big houses, but certainly E.F. Benson, who was an habitué of the big houses, depends on your social circle, I guess. Wouldn't it be nice to go to the big house? I mean, let's forget all that stuff about, yeah, you'd be cleaning the brasses. Let's just pretend we have been invited for the weekend and that our hosts are absolutely lovely. And Topley, we have to go on a bit because Topley Hall is now in the hands of the married sister, who of course would have inherited all Dunton's wealth because she was his heir. So now she's got all that money. And he's a bit of a, God knows what he spent his money on. See, I shouldn't have said that. Heaven knows what he spent his money on. But maybe he was a louche, maybe he drank and gambled. Or maybe he was a miser and just counted it. But I'm sure his married sister, who is fictional, obviously, but even, you know, let's imagine she's real because she's so long ago, all the people who lived down are pretty much fictional anyway. You know what I mean? They might as well be fictional, is what I'm saying. So an unknown person who died in 1913, there's very little of them left, just some records. And you go even further back to about 1600. Most people aren't recorded at all. They may as well have been fictional. And that's what they'll say about me one day. He wasn't, they'll say, but he may as well have been. But then he wouldn't have lived. If he'd been fictional, he wouldn't have been so untidy. Okay. That was good. So Nicholas Hewitt sent me that. So thank you very much, Nicholas. What else did I want to say? Let's think about the story itself. So it's a frame story, isn't it? It's a story of somebody telling a story. So it, the frame isn't specific. I mean, the first one is you're sitting, not much description as to where they're sitting and everything like that, but they're sitting down, and then we go straight into the story, and the man tells the ghost story to our very common, we always talk about Henry James, Turn of the Screw, but it's a really common situation for ghost stories. And it's something to do with creating that distance. It's all like, you know, I don't. If you told me, I wouldn't believe you. But if you told me a friend told you, and this is what in events happening, the narrator is our eye onto the scene, and he's telling us what this guy told us. And he himself is only, he's not intimately emotionally concerned with it massively, although he did like the Admiral. So I think, let's think about why people like Tolkien so much. Because I think he's a good example of this, and why people watch Midsummer Murders. Because I used to watch Midsummer Murders and I got really bored with the plot. I don't have a long attention span, to be fair, and as you can see, my mind just dances around. I need to be medicated. Funnily enough, I had a patient the other day who's 52, and his sister has now told him he's got ADHD, and he goes, well, I probably have, maybe has. And she said, unless you're medicated, we can't have a relationship. And I thought that's pretty unethical, saying to somebody, I want you sedated, or not in that case, but, you know, it's like saying, you know, I want you on Mogadon so you don't cause me any trouble. It's very unethical. See how my mind jumps about? So, yes, I can't even remember where it was. It was talking about, let's get back to the story. Let's use the story as our anchor. And it's a frame story. It is, it's just a very simple plot, as a short story should be. It only says one thing. It isn't startling. Oh, I was talking about milieu, wasn't I? Midsummer Murders. It's just because of the dinky countryside, not the story. And Tolkien, it's the Shire. It's Lothlorien. It's, we want to go there. We want to live there, you know? And so Tolkien also has a good story as well. But so I don't think I'm saying that because I'm not. But I'm saying massive appeal, I think, is the world building. And in this, in a minor sense, this is a very pleasant place to visit, even in fiction. A nice old house with fantastic pictures and armour. And we kind of vicariously are dropped into this, and we go, oh yeah, and especially because it's inherited by somebody nice at the end, it's like, yeah, that could be me. We're seeing through the eyes of our interlocutors here, or people who are telling us the stories, not actually interlocutor, correspondent, I suppose, respondent, and anyway, reportage. So yeah, I think that's one of the lovely things. So in terms of story, it's very simple. It's a revenge story. It's revenge enacted by a ghost. This is a very typical thing that ghosts do. There's absolutely nothing new. There are no new ideas in any of this. However, it's still a very pleasant and good story because he manages. There are two things he manages to do really well, I think. One is it's very well written. I mean, this man read a lot of books. It's very well constructed and written. The prose is lovely. It just flows. Apart from I had to stop a lot of times, but that's me, not him. That's because I'm tired. So it's well written. The story is not massively novel. It's not a novel either. It's a short story, but it's not new. It creates the milieu very well. It puts us in the scene exceptionally well, and it's a place we want to go. So I think that is the chief charm of the story. The other thing, as our avatar, the story absolutely, and this is one of the main purposes of storytelling, as far as I can tell, is to satisfy our sense of morals. We were talking about ethics briefly before, but the morality and the ethicality of, we have the art dealer who is, yeah, mainly moral. He recognises it as being a terrible shame, but he's us as well, because how many times do we see things that we think, that's not on, you know, but we don't go in guns blazing because we need the money, because we need the job, because we don't want to upset Aunt Dora, so we just zip it, you know. So he is every man, the art dealer, that's who he is. He's us. He's not massively brave, but he has a moral sense, And Elliot, the agent, again, is another moral character. So he and the villain, Dunton, is unremittingly vile. He has no redeeming features. He's venal, you know. He's only interested in money. He is the man, as Oscar Wilde said, I think it was Oscar Wilde said, that he knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. And that's him. He has no sentimentality, even to himself, you know. And so that's his sin. Remember, ghost stories, horror stories are about the punishment of sin in many cases. And this is his sin, and he's punished for it. So it is an absolutely classic affirmation. None of us are going to disagree with this. Well, somebody, you've got contrarians out there who go, yeah, you know, they're the people who play Dungeons and Dragons and always choose to be the chaotic evil character and go around doing evil things, you know, just cause. And I always think that's a very adolescent thing to do. But for most of us decent people, I'm talking to you, obviously, and me, we know what's right. And we know that this guy is a pig, and he deserves what's coming to him, and it's completely set up. And so the two satisfactions, and I've been very long-winded about saying this, so I think the three satisfactions, so I'm going to find another one in a minute. The three satisfactions are, it's really well written, number one, very pleasant language. Number two, it has a lovely environmental setting. The milieu where he puts us is really good, is a place we want to be. And the third is, it is morally satisfying. The bad guy gets his comeuppance. None of those are... I mean, the writing is not an uncommon thing. Not a common thing, you know. Good writing is less common than you think. But he manages it. The second, of course, he does very well. The third, the moral satisfaction is probably the easiest thing to do in a story. But he does that as well. So actually, a very good story, A.N.L. Munby. And thank you very much to Nicholas Heward for sending me a copy all the way across the Atlantic, paying the postage to send me the photocopies, and rock and roll. Now, that kind of sparks something before I finish. There's a guy called, I won't say his name, but he's an Irish guy who got in touch with me. He's an illustrator. And I've been bandying this idea about doing a classic ghost stories magazine, like a print magazine, with classic ghost stories, and he's going to illustrate them. And he was talking about using, I think it's Ver Sacrum, or Ware, if you're going to be classical Latin, Sacrum, which was in the early 19th century, the Austrian Jugendstil, the Austrian succession, which was like an Art Nouveau, specifically in Austrian parts of Germany. Very flowery, lovely. If you've ever been to Vienna, it's all over the place. It's gorgeous, you know. They did a magazine. They had a kind of a movement magazine. And he was talking about using that as the template for it and us producing. And I said to him, well, I don't know anything about producing magazines, but I'd really love to have a go. So I think he's going to do the illustrations. I've selected some stories. We've got to pay somebody to print it, obviously. And I've got to pay him. I don't think he should do it for nothing. If I do it for nothing, that's my lookout, isn't it? I hope it sells and I don't do it for nothing. That would be great. But I think we've got to have 300 copies printed, which is a big ask to... Then I've got to market them and sell them. But that'll all be a nice challenge. Ideally, I'd like to sell advertising in the back. So I was thinking, well, who would advertise? And I was thinking maybe some of these hotels who advertise themselves as haunted, maybe ghost tours, maybe ghost walks, maybe... other kind of podcasts may advertise, but I have no real experience. I had a job once selling advertising door to door. That was I was a grim failure at it. But I need somebody to do that. So if you know any agencies that would take that or sell, and we'll obviously give them a cut, that would be really cool. So yeah, I might as well tell you before we finish. Last story. So basically, I had lost my job in London and I was desperate for another job, and this company sold advertising on calendars. You know, you used to get these wall calendars and you'd have the dates in the middle, and then you'd have companies, businesses, local businesses would advertise around and about, and they were usually for charities. So this particular one was for a kidney charity. So he had a lot of workers. I had to have my own car. I drove out to the Medway towns So Rochester and... I think actually it was Gillingham and Chatham I was mainly walking around. And my job was walking around all the businesses, cold calling them, knocking them on the door and trying to sell them some advertising. And most of them just, you know, imagine this cold calling. They didn't want anything to do with me. Some were nice. Some told me to sling me hook in no uncertain terms. Others were very pleasant and were like, no, no, thank you. And some were like, yeah, okay. And I did manage to sell some advertising, but then I was plagued by two moral qualms. And one was that the charity didn't get this money. The charity got nothing out of it. What they did was lend their name and they would get free advertising on the walls of all these businesses. And this with this calendars going out, they were free, the calendars. So that was their deal. So the kidney charity got not a penny, but got its name plastered on a lot of walls. And it was obviously happy with that. But people thought they were supporting the charity. So I had to tell them straight. So they were even mistaken about that. And other people thought that this was going to really boost their business. And I wasn't convinced about that. So after about day three of walking these walls, doors, roads, doors, knocking on doors, walking roads, I phoned this guy up and I said, look, I can't do this. He was going to send me up to Bedford after that, I think. And I said, I just can't do it. And he said, okay, well, you're leaving me with a problem here. So I had to get somebody else to do it. And I didn't get paid a red cent for any of that. So, but there we are. It was an adventure. And it was, I had to get another job. What did I do after that? I think I went to work for London Underground in the payroll office. I did enjoy that job. I've got stories to tell about that as well, obviously. Maybe one day.
Everybody dies, don't they?
Some come back.
Isn't that so?
Isn't that so? Isn't that so?